Good morning, everyone. We're on page 683 at Blake. We've been following Savitri on her quest, her further quest. She has reached the realm of everlasting day. And there she has met, we read the last section, how she turns and finds the living knot and source of all those marvelous worlds, these numberless higher heavens and realms. And she recognizes him as the same being she has been facing in other worlds, in the worlds of everlasting night and in the world of the double twilight. She has been facing him as death and night, the negative force who was trying to persuade her to give up her aspiration to return to earth with living Satyavan. So last time we looked at this Godhead who carries in himself all worshipped eyes, looking through his eyes, who carries within himself the four aspects, the aspect of Virat, the Lord of the material world, the aspect of Hiranyagarbha, the dreamer of the subtle worlds, the aspect of the supreme wisdom from which the other two have emerged. And beyond that supreme wisdom, the fourth ineffable, unknowable state, the Turiya. So at the end, there was a description again of this Godhead. He seemed the wideness of a boundless sky. He seemed the passion of a sorrowless earth. He seemed the burning of a worldwide sun. And the two of them look at each other. Two looked upon each other. Soul saw soul. They encounter each other as equals. So we'll go on from there. What is happening next? You like to start, yeah? Would you start?
Then, like an anthem from the heart's lucent cave, a voice soared up whose magic sound could turn the poignant weeping of the earth to sobs of rapture, and her cry to spirit song. O human image of the deathless world, how hast thou seen beyond the topper's walls the gleaming sisters of the divine gate, summoned the genie of their wakeful sleep, and under revelation's arches forced the carved thought shrouded doors to swing apart, unlocked the avenues of spiritual sight, and taught the entries of a heavenlier state to thy rapt soul that bore the golden key.
Thank you. So this is the voice of that Godhead. It sounds, Sri Aurobindo says, like an anthem, a sacred song. Anthems are chanted in churches, sacred songs with a special evocative mantric rhythm. But this anthem is coming up from the cave of the heart, which is full of light, lucent cave. And the sound of that voice is just magical. It rises up and it seems to have the power to transform, to turn all the poignant weeping of the earth to sobs of rapture, of intense delight. Poignant is painful. Sorrowful weeping of the earth. Our earth carries so much suffering and is suffering so much herself. But the sound of this voice has the power to turn that weeping into sobs of rapture. If you are in a state of intense delight, you may not be able to contain it. It may come out in a kind of sob, almost like weeping. And that cry of earth, her cry for help, her aspiration for a better state, it can turn that to spirit song, the song, the delightful and delighted song of the spirit's ecstasy. And this voice, this Godhead, he asks her a question, but this question is a kind of congratulation. He says, how have you done it? How could you do it? He addresses Savitri. He calls her the human image of the deathless word. She is, in fact, an embodiment, a representation of the deathless word, the word of creation, which has said yes to this manifestation and to time and space and this unrolling of the divine through the long, slow process of evolution. All that was expressed in a single word of creation which goes on vibrating. And the embodiment of that sound is the mother. And Savitri is a supreme, is a earthly embodiment of the supreme divine mother. So he asks her, how hast thou seen? How have you seen beyond the topaz walls? Topaz is a golden colored gemstone. No, topaz is usually golden color. There may be other colors of topazes, I don't know, but when we speak of the color topaz, it's a kind of golden color. I have forgotten the occult significance of the topaz. If anybody knows, they can share us.
Is it for protection?
It might be protection, yes. So then these walls are protecting. They're protecting the higher worlds, the heavens, no? And he says, you've seen beyond the topaz walls, you have seen the sisters, the gleaming sisters of the divine gate. There are two female guardians of the gate through the walls. And he says that those gleaming sisters are in a state of wakeful sleep, a kind of trance, which is nevertheless watchful. And he says, you have summoned, you've called up the genii, the spirits of their wakeful sleep, and under revelation's arches forced the carved, thought-shrouded doors to swing apart. So those doors can only open when the divine sisters agree, no? So in some way, Savitri has persuaded them to open up those doors for her so that she can enter under the arches. A gateway often has a high arch. This is the arches of revelation, This is one of the higher levels of spiritual mind. So those doors are shrouded, covered by thought. But if we reach the level of revelation, the doors can open and show us things that we could not be conscious of before. So by opening up the doors, the Divine Sisters have unlocked the avenues of spiritual sight for Savitri. An avenue is a broad, open street. In the old cities, when one entered through the gate, the main gate, one would enter perhaps an avenue. So there's a long view opened up to the spiritual sight. And he says, you have taught the entries of a heavenly estate to thy rapt soul. You have found, you've taught your soul the way to enter into this heavenly estate that you are in now. You have taught that to your rapt soul, your soul that is in a state of ecstatic trance, and your soul is carrying the golden key, the golden key that will unlock the secrets of the divine worlds. Anybody would like to ask anything about that passage?
I would like to ask concerning line 444, the Gleaming Sisters of the Divine Gate. Do you know by any chance if there is a personalization, they are sisters, or the two parts of the gate?
It's probably the two parts of the gate, but when he uses this word sisters, he's implying female forces, shaktis.
Because I could not see the sisters, you know, in all the stories, I can't come to sisters that...
There's a pair of them, you know.
I think it's a Vedic symbol.
Yes.
Can
you tell us anything more about it, Larry?
No, not really, but I think it represents that gate and, in a way, a personalization.
You know, here in the temples, there are always at the gate to the Sanctum Sanctorum, the doors, there are two guardian figures, one on each side, and they're always male. But here he's saying sisters. Whether this refers to the Vedic image of the two sisters, one of whom, each of whom gives birth to the other one, that is the sisters of night and dawn, I don't know. Could be, one might think so. It's a possibility. She has to go beyond night and dawn to enter into this. But she's already done that. No? Well, he's asking her, how could you do it? How could you come into this world of everlasting day? You read?
In thee, the secret sight, man's blindness missed, has opened its view past time, my chariot course and death, my tunnel, which I drive through life, to reach my unseen distances of bliss. I am the first search of the jealous gods, pursuing my wisdom's vast, mysterious world, seized in the thousand meeting ways of heaven. I am the beauty of the unveiled ray, drawing through the deep roads of the infinite night, the unconquerable pilgrim soul of earth beneath the flaring torches of the stars. I am the inviolable ecstasy. They who have looked on me shall grieve no more.
Thank you. So he's introducing himself. We've seen this before in for example, in Canto 4 of Book 7, where Savitri meets the triple soul forces, three divine Madonnas, and each of them introduces herself to Savitri. So in a similar way, the Godhead is doing that. Anybody would like to ask anything about these lines? So just start with the first one, Don. Before that, we can ask a question. We can say, what is this secret sight that he's talking about? I guess that is this spiritual sight. So this secret sight has opened up in you. This is the sight that man's blindness, the ignorant state of human consciousness, has missed, that spiritual sight. But in you it's opened up, and it can, this spiritual sight can look past time. Time is one of the appearances of our manifestation. You've looked beyond that. But he says that time is his chariot course. It's the way that he drives his chariot on its journey through the manifestation, through the whole process of evolution. Time is the course of that journey. And you've looked past death. And he says, death is my tunnel, which I drive through life to reach my unseen distances of bliss. That's your question. Well, that will come next. Have you understood about death? Have you understood about death? He says, death is like a dark tunnel. No? Through all life, we have to pass again and again and again through this tunnel. But we have to pass through this tunnel to reach my unseen distances of bliss. We drive a tunnel, for instance, for the train to pass through a mountain. You're on one side of the mountain and you actually have no idea what is on the other side. In order to get to the other side and see those unseen distances, you have to pass through the tunnel. So life is like that. It's a series of tunnels. For death is like that, a series of dark tunnels we have to pass through in order to become ready finally to receive the spiritual sight and see the unseen distances of bliss, of divine ananda.
It's a beautiful definition of death, no?
Yes. We get several different definitions of death in the poem. This is a very nice one. A tunnel, you know, you have to cut it through. You have to drive the tunnel, through life.
How to?
Yes, it means again and again and again. Wherever you pass through the tunnel, you're still in life. And then again life, and then again life.
He's referring to the various life, numerous lives that he...
Yeah, I think.
It's just not one life.
I think.
Life is chariot.
The chariot course.
Life can be compared with...
I think those are two different... he says that time is his chariot course. So he's the driver of the chariot, like Krishna. And time is the course along which he's driving his chariot. And then he says, I am the hushed search of the jealous gods. Yes, let's look at that. I think when he says, I am the hushed search, it means I'm what the gods are searching for. And it's hushed, it's kind of secret search. And the gods are jealous. They won't let anybody have this knowledge. They want to have it for themselves. They are not going to spread it very freely. No? They are pursuing the vast, mysterious work of my wisdom. No? He says, which can be seized finally, that work, the meaning of that work, can be seized finally in the thousand meeting ways of heaven, where so many uncountable numbers of possibilities get realized all together in harmony. Gods, each of them is pursuing his own search and his own heaven and his own world, these cosmic overmind powers. But there's a higher realm where they all meet. That's where the wisdom of this vast, mysterious work can be seized. And then he says, I'm the beauty, the attractiveness of the unveiled ray, a ray of supreme light which is not hidden. In him it is not hidden. But that ray, it's the beauty and attraction of that ray which is drawing, attracting the unconquerable pilgrim soul of earth through the deep roads of the infinite night. We are all being attracted. The whole process of evolution is being attracted through the deep roads of the infinite night. But the soul of the earth, of which each of us is a representative, is an unconquerable pilgrim. That pilgrim will go through all the deep roads to the very end. Yes, Don.
Mysterious work, Ray, you suddenly bumped, hit me in the head. Existence, this existence, of which he is it.
Yes, no? Yes. And this unconquerable pilgrim soul of earth is traveling through the deep roads of the infinite night beneath the flaring torches of the stars. I think I've mentioned before that the symbolic significance of the stars and the starry sky, it's the many truths. Each of those is a light, a guiding light. They are the flaring torches of divine truth. So we are following, we are pilgrims on that way through the night, the infinite night, but we are being led and watched over by those flaring torches showing us the way. And then he concludes this introduction. He says, I am the inviolable ecstasy, the ecstasy that has no scar or imperfection, no possibility of imperfection in it anywhere. They who have looked on me shall grieve no more. If we've seen that face, it will be impossible for us ever to feel grief again. And then he says, the eyes that live in night, even these human eyes, shall see my form. It's a promise that we will reach the end. But now he's going to say something a bit more discouraging. Would you read, Patty?
The eyes that live shall see my form. On the pale shores of foaming, steely straits that flow beneath the grey, tormented sky, two powers from one original ecstasy bore. face near but parted in the life of man. One leans to earth, the other yearns to the skies. Heaven in its rapture dreams of perfect earth. Earth in its sorrow dreams of perfect heaven. The two longing to join yet walk apart, idly divided by their vain conceits. They are kept from their oneness by enchanted fears. Sundered mysteriously by miles of thought, they gaze across the silent gulfs of war, side by side, reclined upon my vase. Like bride and bridegroom magically divorced, they wake to yearn, but never can they clasp. While thinly flickering hesitates uncrossed, between the lovers on their nuptial couch, the shadowy eidolon of a sword.
Thank you. It's like a riddle, isn't it? There's a picture, first of all. The pale shores of foaming, steely straits. A straits is a narrow body of water. And often when there's a narrow body of water like that, with land on both sides, there will be strong currents passing in both directions. So the water may be very troubled. There may be foam on the surface. And he says these straits are steely. They're a kind of gray color. And they are flowing beneath a gray, tormented sky, a stormy sky with clouds being blown hither and thither. On these two pale shores of these straits, there are two powers walking. They are pacing, they are near to each other, but they are separated by that strait. They are two powers born from one original ecstasy. They have the same parentage, but they are separated. Pace near, but parted in the life of man. In our life, these two powers, which have the same origin, are separated. One of them leans to earth, the other is yearning for the skies. And then he gives the answer. He says, heaven, in its rapture, in its delight, its ecstasy, is dreaming of perfect earth. Not the imperfect earth we know now, the earth as it should be, the golden earth. And earth in its sorrow is dreaming of perfect heaven. These are the two powers. They are near but separated in our life. And they are always longing to join, but they are walking apart on the opposite shores of this steely straits. He says they're idly divided by their vain conceits. They are unnecessarily separated by their own consciousness. There's something wrong with their own consciousness. They are kept from their oneness by enchanted fears. There's no real reason for those fears. Just somebody's put a spell on them, these enchanted fears. And they are sundered, separated mysteriously by miles of thought. And they gaze at each other across the silent gulfs of sleep. Here it probably means unconsciousness.
Sundered.
Sundered, it means separated. Can be cut. Sundered, severed. They gaze at each other across these silent gulfs of sleep, an area of unconsciousness. Or then he gives another image, no longer the image of the two beings on opposite shores of a narrow body of water. Another image he gives that they are like a bride and a bridegroom who've been magically divorced, also been separated by some bad spell. They are lying side by side upon my vasts in the universe, as if the universe is their bed. They wake up and they yearn for each other, but they are never able to embrace because between them there's a sword, the shadowy eidolon of a sword. It's flickering as if it's a fiery sword that's hesitating there, and they don't dare to cross it, these lovers, on their nuptial couch. This is their marriage bed, but they don't dare to embrace.
So the sword may actually not exist, but they imagine it exists.
Yeah. It's an image from the story of Tristan and Isolde. If anybody knows the story of
Hilda,
yes. He was supposed to escort her to her husband, but on the way he gets given a magic potion, they fall in love, and so I think it's on the journey. They have to pass through a forest. It's night, so he places his sword between them. They lie down on the ground and he places his sword between them. And her future husband, King Mark, comes and he finds them like that. And he understands that they may be in love, but they haven't consummated their love. He hasn't been betrayed. That's Tristan.
Oh, he's between them.
That's the image. Yeah.
Enchanted.
Sorry?
Enchanted fears.
To me, it suggests that there's no real base to those fears. It's somehow some magic spell has made them fearful. But there's no real basis, no true basis for those fears. They are just enchanted fears. He says that these two powers of heaven and earth, we can say the higher consciousness and the nature consciousness, are separated in our life. And our big... He says heaven and earth. So I'd like to stick to that. Yeah. There's our... she said, is it Purusha and Prakriti? Just in this context, I'd like, we can say heaven is the divine consciousness and earth represents the nature consciousness here in the material universe. Actually, they are one.
Yes.
They are born from one ecstasy and they are meant to embrace, they are meant to marry, but they're kept separate by these idly divided by their vain conceits, their concepts. That's what keeps them apart, their ideas, it's the wrong word, conceits, he says.
Is it not also that the mother said that apart from our soul incarnates in us and then it has to develop to unite, no? This higher power?
Yes,
yeah. It's mental formations, right?
I think it's mental formations, yes. But he says there, their vain conceits. So heaven has one misconception and earth has the other misconception.
Well, oh, you mean that the heaven doesn't have mental formations?
Excuse me?
Yeah.
As if materialism and spirituality can't come together in many ways.
Well, that's one of the ways in which they are divorced, yes. But such beautiful language, such a beautiful way of expressing it. And this two images, and they wake to yearn, but never can they clasp between while thinly flickering hesitates uncrossed between the lovers on their nuptial couch, the shadowy eidolon of a sword. It's as if they feel that there's something forbidding them to unite. Some prohibition. Yes, Prasad.
See, the two, line 470, ever is in the structure, dreams of perfect earth. So we dream of something that we miss.
Yes.
And so in the heaven, they miss something.
They are longing for a perfect earth, dreaming
so
of
they
it.
They are missing something. What is that they are missing?
They're missing the divine life upon earth.
In heaven, no?
Hmm?
Oh, okay.
Missing the divine life and the material universe.
And Mother also said that even the gods have to come to earth if they want to progress.
Yes.
Maybe that is something they miss in heaven.
Yes.
So
but they're not all missing. But what they are dreaming of is the earth perfected so that they can lead their divine life here in the material universe. And here on earth, we are dreaming of those paradises. No? Yes, they just can't get together. Yes. Yeah. Mother seems to say that, yes. That the inner progress, not only the outer progress, but the inner growth can only happen. Otherwise, the gods are what he calls typal beings. It's as if they are fixed in their nature. So if they want to move beyond that fixed nature, if they want to go higher, they would have to incarnate or associate themselves with a human incarnation in order to have this possibility. This is the unique gift of the earth, is this possibility of progress, of evolution.
So they dream of making it perfect so they can comfortably come here.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And we'll be very grateful if they do.
So they have to cooperate.
Yes, but they are idly divided. They are separated, sundered. Yeah.
But aren't they us? Aren't we idly divided?
That's what he says. It's happening in the life of man.
Come to earth, they are here on earth. We are in heaven. We are in heaven.
But we are not, huh?
But we don't know.
Be realistic, Don. We are not. No. We will see why he's telling her this. If we read on, we will see. Why is he telling her all this? Yes.
Gods have a wish to come to earth to progress.
Some gods, some, not all gods. Some gods say, no, it's too tough for me. Later, when it's perfect.
But some have come and they have progressed. And what does it mean? When they go back again, they are in a higher status or in the same again?
I don't know at all, ma'am. Well, they have some kind of experience that they couldn't have in their typal world. That's all I can say.
Is driving, and death is the tool for this evolution.
But he's not death anymore. We shouldn't think of him as death anymore. This is the Lord. He disguised himself.
The darkness, the tunnel through which he drives.
Death is an instrument and a mask of the divine Lord. Here he's showing himself in a more radiant form. But we shall see, he's still trying to persuade Savitri that she can't take Satyavan back. He's explaining that heaven and earth are separated, they are divided.
I read something last night which really was a revelation, I think, in relation to this. It was a note that Sri Aurobindo made on love and death. So he was describing ideal love. He said ideal love is three things. It should be a combination of sensuality, of emotions, and spirituality. These three things. So this is the basic problem, actually, between heaven and earth. They can't seem to get it together.
Exactly.
I mean, because one says one thing is forbidden and the other says no, no.
Yes.
So love is the only thing that can bridge. True love can bridge.
And that's what Savitri represents. Right?
Ah, yes.
That's the whole mission, is to bridge this gap.
Right.
But here this Godhead who's now confronting her is still insisting that this bridge can't be crossed. This gap can't be crossed. So let's see what he says next. Whose turn is it? Yours.
But when the phantom flame edge fails undone, then never more can space or time divide the lover from the loved. Space shall draw back her great translucent curtain. Time shall be the quivering of the spirit's endless bliss. Attend that moment of celestial fate. Meanwhile, you too shall serve the dual law, which only now the scouts of vision glimpse, who, pressing through the forest of their thoughts, have found the narrow bridges of the gods. Wait patient of the brittle bars of form, making division your delightful means of happy oneness, rapturously enhanced by attraction in the throbbing air between.
Read it very carefully. So there's this shadowy eidolon of a sword separating heaven from perfect earth. Earth from perfect heaven. But he says, but when that shadowy eidolon, when that phantom flame edge fails, undone, when it's dissolved, that magic, no? Then nevermore can space or time divide the lover from the loved. Heaven and earth will be able to unite. Space will draw back her great translucent curtain, as if it's a curtain dividing us from heaven. And time shall be the quivering, the intense delight of the spirit's endless bliss. He says, wait. Wait for that moment of celestial fate. It's destined. It will happen. Wait. Meanwhile, you too, Savitri and Satyavan, will serve the dual law, the two-sided law, the law of spirit and matter, soul and nature, perhaps. He says that dual law for now is only glimpsed by scouts of vision, ones who go ahead and scout out, reconnoiter, see what is ahead. No? They press, those scouts who are pressing ahead of where evolution has reached now, where Earth nature has achieved now, they press through the forest of their thoughts, that thick forest of thoughts. And in doing that, they have found some narrow bridges between earth and heaven. And they've seen this dual law, how the two are connected, what is their relationship. So the Godhead tells Savitri to wait. Be patient. Be patient about these brittle bars of form, these easily breakable, actually, bars which are separating you from Satyavan. These are the bars of form. No? He says, enjoy this separation. Make division your delightful means of happy oneness. You can be one in a sense, but you'll be separated by the form. And that enjoyment of your oneness will be rapturously enhanced, be intensified by the power of attraction which is throbbing in the air between, that's separating the two of you. That will be an extra delight, he's telling her.
I'm thinking that Sri Aurobindo is intending the goal of this book is going ultimately going to be physical immortality on earth.
Yes.
Because I was reading in the library here this morning this small book called The Triumph of Love by Shiv Dutt Sharma. He has retold the Savitri story. But at the end he says that the story was such, I suppose he's speaking only in the Mahabharata, is that Savitri only, that they would live 400 years. She did not have the intention that it was a total conquest of death.
No, that's very clear. In the traditional story, it's not a total conquest of death. And even in this story, it's not an immediate total conquest of death. We will find on later on in this book that after granting Savitri the boon that Satyavan can return with her to earth, he prophesies what's going to happen for the next few thousand years. And he says, eventually, at the end, there will come the conquest of death and the death of ignorance. Finally, in the end. So that is definitely a characteristic of the divine life in the material universe, that unintentional death need not happen, eventually.
And love would have to be more widespread, in other words, not just Satyavan
yes.
Savitri.
Yes.
Because here he says, time shall be the quivering of the spirit's endless bliss.
Yes.
Attend that moment of celestial faith.
Wait for it. That's exactly what
there.
The Supreme Divine Mother told to Aswapati. No? He wanted her to descend to earth in her full incarnation with all her power and glory and everything. And she says, wait. It's not time yet. Nothing is ready yet. So, but then he has the courage and the persistence to say, but it's all taking far too long. And we don't see even a glimmer of your presence. Please, won't you send an emanation of yourself to earth to speed up the evolutionary process? And she says yes. So that emanation who comes with that mission to fulfill the aspiration of King Aswapati is his daughter Savitri. And she's already done a great deal, but she still has the last obstacles to overcome. Yes, dual, it means there's a duality, a law of opposition. So an opposition between earth and heaven. But those oppositions can be useful. In Book 1, Canto 4, Sri Aurobindo has described these pure spiritual powers that are ruling above in heaven, who aren't touched by our sufferings at all. They're absolutely pure and immaculate. And he said if they would come down and in sympathy, in love, they wouldn't be able to help. They have to be like that. No? And the earth has to be the way that it is. But there is a hand, even in the darkest moments, when all that we can see is death and bail, an outstretched hand still guides us through all.
But for love, you have to have lover and beloved.
Yes.
But I wonder how many couples are trying to be one. It would be an interesting survey to take on earth.
The impulse of love is oneness. But what we experience here as love is such an imperfect and distorted form of divine love. But still, Savitri defends it. She says, human love, it's still divine. So long as we don't make it too selfish and too self-centered. Anyway, that's another story. Let's read a little further. Lupa.
Yet is all Buddhist abandon who accept one, careless of the dark moon of things below, tread down the isthmus, overleap the flood, cancel thy contract with a laboring force, renounce the tie that joins thee to earth's king.
Kind.
Cancel. Cast off thy sympathy with mortal hearts. Arise, vindicate, conquer life. Relinquishing thy charge of transient breath under the cold gaze of the indifferent star. Leaving thy borrowed body on the soul. Ascend, O soul, into thy blissful home. Here in the playground of the eternal child, or in domains the wise immortals tread, roam with thy comrade splendor under skies, spiritual lead by the unsetting sun, as Godheads we who care not for the world, and share not in the toil of nature's powers, absorbed in their self-ecstasy they dwell. Cast off the ambiguous moon of earth desire, all mortal, to felicity and rest.
That last line.
So he's giving her a choice. You can be patient, go back to earth, live without Satyavan, only with the inner connection. Or if you like, you can stay here with me in heaven. If you are willing to abandon the troubled world, the vexed world, if you don't care about that dark moan of things below on earth, then there's only a narrow isthmus, a tiny strip of land. You can walk down there and just leap over this strait between earth and heaven. You can cancel your contract, your agreement with the laboring force, the force of earth evolution. You can renounce, give up the tie that joins you to earth kind, to human beings. You can cast off your sympathy with mortal hearts, hearts that have to die. Come up here. Vindicate thy spirit's conquered right. You've done everything necessary to come to heaven. You've earned that right. So you can just give up thy charge of transient breath, this responsibility, this burden of human breath. You can just leave your body where it is, there, lying on the sod, on the ground. It's only a borrowed body, after all. No? You can just leave it there, under the cold gaze of the indifferent stars who don't care anyway. No? You can ascend, O soul. Leave the body. A soul, you can ascend into your blissful home. And then you have different possibilities. You can enjoy the playground of the eternal child, or you can enjoy the domains where the wise immortals tread, along with Satyavan, with your comrade splendor. You can roam under these skies that are spiritual skies lit by an unsetting sun. There's no night or mist in this realm of everlasting day. You can live like individual divine beings who don't care about the world at all and who haven't agreed to share the toil, the labor of the powers of nature, earth nature. Those kind of beings, those divine beings, just live absorbed in their self-ecstasy. So you too have the truth, the choice. You can throw off this ambiguous myth of earth's desire. You are an immortal. You can rise up into Ananda, to ecstasy. Cast off the ambiguous myth of earth's desire.
It's more than a choice that he's giving. He's trying to lure her.
He's giving her the choice because actually he's telling her very clearly what it will mean. She would have to give up her mission, her commitment. No, no, she is demanding that Satyavan, the soul of humanity, her husband, her other part, should be returned to earth. And she's demanding that because she believes this is important for earth's future. In heaven, yes. Not on earth.
Yes, but why is she insisting on being on earth? Coming back to the earth.
She wants to bring... She could come back to earth. He says you can easily go back to earth. But then you have to live separated from Satyavan. So the meaning of the story is that she is on earth to save the soul of humanity. Represented by Satyavan. The soul of humanity is in the grip of ignorance and death, and her mission is to change that. And the way she will change it is by her insistence on the union between her and Satyavan. They can't be separated. They have to be together. Is it clear? Thank you.
Because actually, this is something, this coming back from death is something that's already been done by a few people. But I'm thinking, the fundamental problem of the deterioration of matter is not dealt with in this book. Because they're both young, you know? The whole idea of getting old is not the issue yet. But
symbolically, of course, it is dealt with, no? The indignities of mortal life, the inadequacies of matter to express the divine consciousness. That's the whole point. So we have to get to the end before we can get to the end. We still quite many pages, but I think we'll stop there for today. He says, Savitri, you are an immortal soul, so you can leave your body on the earth and come up to the state of Ananda, of bliss, here in heaven. You can enjoy that with Satyavan because he's already here.
Felicity
is bliss, ecstasy, rapture. This is this Godhead. So he's the same one who faced her as death and night.
Okay.
And now he's facing her like this. And he will go on facing her. But finally he will tell her, all right, but not here. Here you can't make this choice. You will have to go beyond the manifestation. You'll have to leave these symbol worlds I will help you. You go there, you see there, from there, how everything is and how it's all been set up, and then make your choice. And then he makes her choose. Some pages further on.
Can I please read this definition of felicity here? It's really nice.
For what?
Felicity.
Felicity. What does it say about felicity?
Intense happiness, bliss or delight, often carrying the sense of such a state empowered to foster a like condition of happiness in others by its influence. More than happiness, wow.
Yes.
What?
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.